Thank you for downloading this Euromoney Online Channels podcast for April 2013. Please visit our website at euromoneyconferences.com/online channels to register for more downloads, more podcasts, audio and video of our live events. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Euromoney Online Channels podcast for April 2013. This month, we're looking at the Middle East, specifically at the general market environment at the moment, Egypt, the Sukuk market, and we'll close out with a preview of our Saudi Arabia conference, which takes place in early May. Joining me on the podcast are Angus Blair, president of the Signet Institute, who's on the line from Cairo, and Dan Alderson, who is the editor of IFIS, the Islamic Finance Information Service, another part of the Euromoney group. Hello, Angus. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
Hello.
Angus, I'm going to start with you. Sentiment in the Middle East particularly now seems to be divided between really two areas. The GCC seems to be relatively happy, buoyed on the back of oil prices still north of $100. The rest of the region, by which I mean the Levant, Egypt, and the North Africa, seems to be in a state of quite poor sentiment, negative outlook. Do you view that as a reasonable division?
Yeah, it's interesting, obviously, that in a region that's full of change, that the least change is happening, whereas the greatest wealth. But of course, that's there are obviously economic reasons for that, and that the populations generally are well employed and are basically pretty happy financially. But it's quite difficult to measure change and political sentiment across the region. But as I said from the very beginning of the uprisings across the Arab world, every country would be affected, but the change would be different in every country. The substance and form of it would be very different. I think that across the GCC, there's been very considerable ways to the population. Saudi Arabia has had a giveaway budget last year, about a year and a half ago, of about around $150 billion. There's a very large infrastructure program to spend on both transport and health and education. And Qatar and Oman have given over the last year, Oman more recently, 60% pay rises to government employees. So when you look at that, you realize that that giveaway is a part of that political process to try to appease the local population. But it's a short-term answer to the economic and structural issues that need to be addressed that the other countries, particularly the Mediterranean Arab states, have dealt with or are dealing with or will have to deal with, particularly with subsidies and so on, which you might want to cover later in the conversation.
But do you think, Angus, that the unrest and inaction in Arab Spring countries like Egypt and Tunisia has had an effect of quietening the demand for change amongst the GCC countries, amongst the populations of the GCC countries?
I think it's clear many citizens do not want to follow the path where there is violence or disruption, that it would rather happen gradually and with evolution. And I think we're seeing it to a marginal degree, particularly in Oman. I think it's sort of leading the way. In Saudi Arabia, there's been some progress where the king just placed women onto the Shura Council, which was very interesting a few months ago. But it's perhaps the concern for me is where there has been control of dissent, where people have been arrested for criticizing leaders, bloggers, poets, people who tweet. I think that's in a world where people are very interconnected. I think that kind of heavy-handed response to change or critique is really out of touch with the general trend across the world. And I think that the leaders of the GCC particularly will have to allow greater criticism. But they've put the walls up to an extent, and I'm not sure that's the best response to a world that really is more outspoken. And I think that there are pressures for change because they're very young demographics across this region, and young people who are sitting in Dubai or Abu Dhabi or Bahrain or Riyadh or Kuwait are talking with other people young people elsewhere in America or in Australia or Eastern Europe, whatever it be, they're communicating and they have very similar aspirations. So I think there's a disconnect between some of the leaders of the region and the younger populations who really demand change and I think more say. And I think that will feed through in time into the economic structures, because if you look at the GCC, you still have the state being almost the first as well as the last employer of resort and large oligopolies that really control significant chunks of the economy. So I'd like to see more free economies, more free discussion, but that I think is a little further out than perhaps I would like, or perhaps even younger people in the region would like.
Do you, final question in this opening sort of regional top-down look, do you think that there is amongst the economies of the region, perhaps particularly those economies of North Africa and the Levant, with the exception of Syria, an understanding of what the economic model should be now that this cataclysmic change has come or continues? I mean, what sort of economies do they want to be? How does political Islam, which seems to be a rising force, relate to the economy?
Well, I have to say, from my view of having covered the region for about 20 years, I'm still concerned that generally there isn't really one economic model that really works across the region of the Middle East and North Africa that's both that's sustainable and efficient. The governments of the GCC remain too large in terms of employing the population. 95% of Kuwaitis work for the government. And I think that's unsustainable longer term. And the numbers are lower elsewhere in the Gulf, but they're still very high. And even elsewhere in the Mediterranean states, government remains too large a component of total GDP. I have to say, I don't think there's enough of a discussion as to what kind of economies people really want or should have in the future. They've grown, of course, organically, and that's not a bad thing. But I think there should be more informed discussion in terms of the economic growth. Political Islam, of course, is still entrepreneurial. If you look at the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, as has been well documented, many of the key members of the Muslim Brotherhood are in business. But they don't really, I think that the weakness comes with a bigger vision of what an economy should be doing. And I think that's where the weakness currently in the debate across the region is, in that the vision and the implementation of it and the competencies of individuals across the region, I still think needs to be improved. I mean, even if you look at Dubai, which is viewed as a good example, it's still been built on debt. And obviously in the last few years, we've had problems with that debt and the repayment of the debt. But it's a model which seems to be attracting many young people across the region, but it came at a cost.
I mean, I would say arguably Dubai is the only part of the region that has economics or economic growth as its foremost principle. The rest of them seem to be stuck somewhere between society, politics, religion. These are the things that are important, not economic growth. And I think we're seeing that in Egypt. We're going to come back to Egypt in more detail in a few minutes. But is that fair to say that there isn't really the Muslim Brotherhood and indeed some of the Gulf monarchies are primarily concerned with stability, with politics, with society, and not with the development of economies, perhaps for different reasons than the Muslim Brotherhood, but economics is not really at the top of the political agenda?
You're right, absolutely right. Dubai obviously was a trading hub and has grown from that in terms of its economic ethos. And it is a program which has worked, at least obviously in terms of growth physically, as well as bringing in a lot of young people from across the region. It is a model which has worked because it's able to attract good talent from across the region to try to create a new form of a city. And in that sense, could be applauded, of course. I think the weaknesses elsewhere in the region is a kind of inheritance of what's happened historically, a kind of patronage, where the state should be the major employer and one's left with a few larger industries that control significant chunks of industry. I think actually, oddly enough, Egypt is a model, it's the most diversified of all of the MENA region economies. And it's worked because it's been more industrialized for longer, more development of higher education historically, but it's become weak, especially in the last few decades. And it's where I think there has to be a better focus on what kind of economy is required for the future, because you need strong growth with very young populations. You need a minimum of 6% real growth in GDP every year. And only really at the moment, Libya and Qatar are meeting that kind of growth that's required to employ enough of the new young people that are coming onto the jobs market every year.
Okay, well, let's come back to that later. Dan, I want to bring you in here as we shift the conversation now to look at an area of particular expertise to you, which is the Sukuk market. Why don't you give us an overview of the last 3.5 months, the first 3.5 months of 2013 in the Sukuk market, and tell us what you think is important and what's going to come up in the next few months before the summer break.
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, there's two ways of looking at this. People look at the sort of global headline figures. And if we look at that, the Sukuk market has actually been a little bit slower than it was this time last year. We're looking at total issuance year to date of about 38.9 billion, according to our IFAS figures. At this stage last year, we had about 49.6. Really what that doesn't take into account is most of this is Malaysian issuance, and Malaysia's got elections coming up this year. So that might be a pretty key factor in that slowdown.
If we strip out the Malaysian numbers.
Yeah, of course. What I wanted to come to. Look at the dollar market, which is where most of the Middle East activity is happening, it's actually a big improvement. We're looking at or big increase, I should say. It's 7.3 billion so far, and that compares to only 3.81 billion at this stage last year. And we've seen a number of dollar deals coming through, I think it's about we've had sort of seven out of the region so far this year. Most recently we had Sharjah Islamic Bank doing a 500 million deal. There's definitely an increase of issuance and an increase of appetite, I think, as well for the asset class globally, which is helping that. We saw this with the recent Saudi electricity company deal, which was the first they managed to do the first 30-year Sukuk, which was quite a breakthrough, or first 30-year benchmark Sukuk anyway in the dollar market. And this was very well received in America. Actually, there's a lot of U.S. investors came in for this. Also, you know, surprisingly, perhaps a good local component to the order book as well. The total book for the deal, which was two tranches, it was a 10-year deal and a 30-year. The total book was 13 billion for that. Very, very tightly priced. Very well received. I think that it exemplifies that what's happening is that the Sukuk asset class, I think last year we saw a lot of sort of education of international investors sort of demonstrating that Sukuk can actually be invested in by anyone who you know, is interested in that area. It's not just exclusively for Islamic investors. And we're seeing that now reaping some rewards. You know, previously, I don't think people would have even last year, people wouldn't have even considered doing a 30-year Sukuk. 10-year was pushing the boundaries. This year, now it's looking like there will be other deals following it. People are already talking about, say, an issue like Qtel, for instance, doing a 30-year. Maybe the Islamic Development Bank could look at it. It's still going to be a select bunch, I would say. They need to be sort of highly regarded, highly rated, and very visible. Saudi electricity company's done a lot of work on that front to make itself more visible and better known by the international investor base. I think this all bodes very well for growth there.
The local currency markets are something that the IMF in particular have targeted as part of the financial system of particularly of the GCC countries that need to be developed, the local currency debt markets. Have we seen any issuance in local currency?
We have seen. There's been some Saudi issuance. The GCC issuers tend to go to the dollar market. That's still the case this year, but there has been some Saudi issuance. That has been the trend of recent years. It's It's been more of a local market for Saudi Arabia. You've seen Islamic financings as well done in Saudi reals, and so it's I think last year we saw more of the issuance going towards the dollar market.
Like issuing in dollars because most of the region's currencies are pegged to the dollar, and it's relatively easy to swap back into local currency if they need it. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
So that would mean, following that train of logic, that other currency issuance, so euro or sterling or yen, or I think there was an Aussie dollar issue, wasn't there, from NBAD or someone like that earlier on this year? And maybe I'm making that up. I have a habit of doing that. But you see that there being the majority of issuance pipeline for the rest of the year being in dollars.
I think, well, we'll see a mixture of, it depends on the company, it depends on how visible they are, it depends on whether they need, whether they want financing in dollars, I suppose, whether they want to go out to the international investor base. You'll still see a lot of Saudi real issuance coming from perhaps some of the less well-known investors, issuers that want to, target local investors. We've seen a few of those examples that are just exclusively for Saudi investors. But you'll see other issuers like the Islamic Development Bank, for instance, that will look at various different currencies depending on, who they want to bring in, who they want to finance, what projects they have on. They're very tied to specific projects.
Sure. The Saudi electricity deal, the 30-year deal, well, the dual tranche 10 and 30-year, you said that a lot of that went to U.S. accounts. Why are U.S. investors investing in Saudi paper? What are they getting? Is it yield pickup? Is it, what's the attractiveness from an international investor point of view in a deal like that?
Well, I think, we saw a few themes coming through last year. I've talked about the global acceptance of the Sukuk asset class and how it's and the pricing of it has been very, aligned with conventional bonds. But also I think that people are very interested in having an asset-backed investment. It's very tangible. You can see immediately what's underlying it, what's backing the investment. There's also, we've talked about this a little bit, but the resurgence of the Middle East last year. I think that Dubai, for instance, did a fantastic job of, slowly feeding positive headlines, which, has had an effect on the region. People are looking at it again, whereas perhaps, a few years ago, they were thinking they would never go back there. There's been a big rally of the asset class and of the issues behind it. And I think that's mainly it. You've got, obviously a Saudi electricity company has done a lot of work on its own as well to make itself, well known and show that it's got a strong business model. It's also backed, it's the closest proxy that people have to the Saudi sovereign as well. So.
Sure. What's the asset that underlies the SEC Sukuk?
Oh, well, they've got their
receivables,
well, they've got their projects that are happening, that they're building new sites, new plants, and etc. I think that's mainly it that people are looking at. It's a pretty strong revenue generator, I would say.
Well, we have the chief executive of Saudi Electricity on stage at the Euromoney Saudi Arabia conference on the 7th of May. So I'll be putting some of those questions to him. Before we go to look a little bit more at Egypt, let's talk about the secondary market. Sukuk, perhaps the Sukuk market, perhaps just because of its sheer size, which is not very big, has always struggled in the secondary market. A lot of the paper is issued, it's buy and hold, it goes to regional accounts particularly, who have not a lot of other things in which they can invest, and they sit on it till maturity. So Dan, what's your opinion on the development of the secondary market? And perhaps you could also talk to this ILM issue last week, the $500 million issue, which Saudi was not part of, but has a role in secondary market. Does it, or am I making that up again?
No, sure. I mean, this has been a long project that started in 2010. It's come from out of Malaysia, but it's for the Islamic market as a whole. It's had various people as part of this. The central banks of, you know, a wide variety of Islamic or related countries. Like, we've had, you know, a range from, say, like Iran, Saudi Arabia, right through to Malaysia, Indonesia. So it's been quite a struggle to sort of align everyone's interests in that and get them on the same page. But they have kind of come through this now, except that Saudi Arabia decided that they wanted to drop out. Their shares were taken up by Malaysia and Qatar, who seem to be the main backers of this. It could be an important breakthrough because the liquidity in the secondary market is, as you say, not very good, because people tend to buy the paper and hold on to it. It's that kind of investor base, but it's also just a lack of sort of instruments that can really stimulate the secondary market.
But what does the ILM transaction do? I mean, it's $500 million, which is, in the grand scheme of things, not very big, especially for a secondary market liquidity facility. What's its purpose? How does it work?
Well, I suppose you've got to remember this is the first of its kind. So it's a sort of it's the debut program. It's got to, you know, fly before any more can be done. But what it will do is it's going to purchase sovereign related assets, which are A1 equivalent rated. Long-term ratings, and then it's going to use that to issue Sukuk of less than 1 year. Now, this is a great boon, perhaps, to Islamic banks who, to date, have not really had much of this kind of short-term liquidity paper that they can use. It's a big problem for there's some big problems for Islamic banks in general, in that they need certain kinds of paper for, you know, Basel requirements. I mean, so far we've had, like, the Islamic Development Bank paper has been perhaps the only highly rated paper that they can use. But it's supposed to serve as a liquidity instrument, but in fact, because of its scarcity, people tend to just buy and hold it. So it's not really that liquid. So that, you know, this is an area that that definitely needs some work. You're right to say that the secondary market for Sukuk in general is not particularly good. You have a short sort of window after issuance in which paper might get traded, and then it tends to sort of be held. It's good and bad in one way, and bad in another, in that, you know, it tends to stabilize fairly quickly. But yeah, there's not much trading going on.
But presumably as a holder of Sukuk, it'd be relatively easy to sell it. It's if you wanted to buy it or trade it in the secondary market that's the difficulty.
Exactly. I mean, when people talk about the liquidity of the Sukuk market, I think they're really talking about the ability to get hold of paper rather than the ability to sell it. There's a huge market for it. There's huge demand. There's a real lack of supply to meet that demand, and that's why you're seeing a lot of issues getting very, very big books, especially recently. What's kind of been interesting with a number of deals we've seen so far is that paper does trade down in the secondary market, and it does raise questions of what, you know, what's happening, whether the order books are as strong as people, you know, I think people tend to inflate their order books because they are.
Really? Gosh, that never happens anywhere.
No, but it
surprised me, Dad.
It especially happens in the Sukuk market. I think we've seen that with, you know, a few deals recently that, when it comes to push comes to shove, they actually don't want as much as they put in for. We saw that with the Turkey sovereign deal last year that, you know, people got over allocated perhaps and because they put in huge orders for it. You know, we've seen some paper trade down, like Dubai's sovereign deal earlier this year traded down. But then, you know, they've they did push it quite hard with the deal, but I think that generally, you know, that people are glad to get hold of paper wherever they can. So it's probably just a short-term dip, I would imagine.
Okay, Jan, thanks very much. That's very interesting. I know in future podcasts we'll come back and we'll drill down a bit on that. I'm particularly interested in looking at the underlying assets of these deals. You know, it has been a question from an investor's point of view in the past that the Sukuk underlying asset has not been as much of a real asset as it might have been. So I think we should be looking a little bit more at that. Another commercial for our Saudi conference. We are focusing the second day of our conference, which is in Riyadh, on the 8th of May, pretty much all on Sukuk, the development of both the dollar and the Saudi riyal market. We have a lot of the major issuers, so if you'd like to join us, please apply as soon as possible, but it'll also be available online soon after the event. I'm going to turn now back to Angus. Dan, please feel free to come in when you want. Angus, let's talk about Egypt, a country that you know better than me, but I know pretty well, having worked with Egypt for more than 12 years. I'd like to kick off by asking you how things are. You're actually on the ground in Cairo, so you live the events day to day at ground level. How are things there, really? We get a lot of negative reporting, I think, from our media here in Europe. I'm sure that's reflected elsewhere in the world. What's the reality on the ground? How are people feeling? What's the sentiment?
Well, Richard, for most people, most of the time, life goes on as roughly normal. And I think that in any event globally, and you could take the example of the London riots, that where everyone thought, gosh, Britain's in a mess, where you have the riots happening all over London. The media, of course, is portraying a certain picture at that time. Now, of course, we can say it's exaggerated, but of course you get blanket media coverage whenever there's a big demonstration here in Egypt or it's mentioned in the press, and there's been a drip of pretty bad news in terms of politics and various demonstrations and violence and so on. The issue, I think, is that for most people, as I said, they do want a kind of normality. That said, Egypt's in a revolution, and it is moving forward in fits and starts and in various degrees, and some of it is unpleasant and some of it's fine. There are various problems where there was an attack on the main center of Coptic Christianity here about just over a week ago, which was very significant. And the various other situations that are happening, strikes and so on. But as I've said, that there are changes. They're more subtle. Sometimes they're more noisy. But we have to get used to the fact that other changes will happen in time in the body politic. There are elections planned for later this year. But right now, the focus is on the economy, and the economy is growing pretty slowly, just about 1 to 1.5%, if that, actually. And foreign direct investment, which used to cover their current account deficit, is now in very low figures because there's only a small amount of money coming into the oil and gas sector to take over some existing investments. So the overall picture is one of concern, added to which, and I've said this for a long time, Richard, you'll remember this, I've been very concerned that inflation generally remains at above global norms, and food price inflation particularly is at unsustainable levels, back into double figures now, year on year, and that's unsustainable for a country like Egypt where people are hurting. So there's increasing tension around that there's low economic growth, food prices are high, and there's been a fall in the currency, so there'll be some imported inflation too.
I mean, there seems to be a narrative that is emerging from Egypt that the economy is in crisis, the political situation is in turmoil, instability is commonplace. But, you know, if the economy has been in crisis now for really two years or a little more, why hasn't it collapsed? I mean, this is what everyone says, well, the economy is going to collapse. It's terrible. It's terrible. Equity markets today, 12% up. This time last year, they've bounced between 30 percent up and 5% up over the course of the last 6 months. So there's some positive sentiment there. Do you share the view that is, I think, commonplace now in international media, that Egypt's economy is in a nosedive? Or are we just going to see what I'm afraid to say we've seen often in Egypt, which is sort of it bounces along the floor for a long period of time. People are long suffering, but they just get on with their life. And eventually it begins to move in the right direction after they've tried everything else.
At the end, Richard, you remember this, there was an economic crisis in Egypt from 1999 to 2004.
Yeah, when
Egypt
was
in a worse state. The people who were in charge at that time were not frankly competent, and the state and the private sector were heavily laden with debts, especially foreign debt. In the last 2 years, the government and the private sector went into this crisis in pretty good shape, low debt and very low, almost negligible foreign debt. So on a macro level, Egypt was pretty strong, big informal sector, very liquid society. Very strong remittances of around $13 billion last year. The fact that it's a pretty diversified economy has meant that you've had a pretty big cushion to help Egypt over the last 2 years. I think many of the people who keep saying, oh, Egypt will be destroyed in a month or two, are people really who really don't know very much about economics or about the situation, quite frankly. Some people in the media and commentators do like a bit of drama in the reporting, but it's a more difficult situation, definitely. The trajectories are definitely more difficult. I think the competencies of the individuals in government could be better. I'm disappointed that still under the present government, who've been in power for quite a while, the president and the cabinet, there's still no strong vision, no pro-growth economic plan. Foreign exchange reserves are difficult. You know that Egypt runs a long-term trade deficit, current account deficit. And because of the lack of money into the stock market, portfolio money, bond money, and particularly foreign direct investment, the majority of which has been in the hydrocarbon sector, has fallen away very, very sharply. It means that on the macro numbers are pretty bad. But the problems are surmountable. The question is, can some people in government actually make the right decisions? And I think that the one
can
comment...
They?
I'm sorry?
Can they?
Yeah.
Will they? I mean, you know, they haven't given much of an indication that they've got the balls to make some tough decisions.
Absolutely. You're quite right. They haven't given an indication, really, and that's a great shame and a major disappointment. I think they're waiting for the elections, Richard. They don't really want to take some of the tough decisions. Some people are afraid to fail. But Egypt does require some pretty tough, quick action to be able to induce domestic sentiment. Start investment. You will remember at the end of the last crisis when Nazif came to power, they pulled a rabbit out of the hat, and their rabbit out of the hat was to cut corporate and personal tax rates almost in half to 20%. The end result was sentiment changed instantly. And if someone said they only made 100,000 Egyptian pounds a year or £1 million a year, the tax authorities believed them. They didn't chase them up. As a result, the tax take increased enormously because the economy was growing strongly.
Yeah,
and the current government's response has been to raise taxes. Well, if people are feeling miserable, as you know in Britain, where you are, if you feel miserable, a dose of higher taxes are not going to make you feel any better.
No, that's true.
So the economy, I think, could do with better, more competent people, I think, who have got better economic vision.
In the few minutes we've got left, let's just talk about the IMF loan. It's become a bit of a totem. It's one of those things that almost every news wire that I see has an announcement from one Egyptian government minister or other about the imminent prospects for a conclusion of the IMF discussions, which would then unleash a tidal wave of other capital, other investment in Egypt. That's been going on certainly for the last 18 months. And not only has nothing actually happened, but the number, 4.8 billion, is the same as it was in May 2011. You know, they haven't adjusted it. Are they serious about this, the Egyptian government? Is the IMF serious about this? Because it doesn't seem to be moving at all.
Well, initially, actually, Richard, the number was just, I think, over 3 billion, but it increased pretty quickly to 4.8 billion. I think that the IMF are frustrated. In fact, I'm sure they're frustrated. And I think disappointed at the fact that that initial aid, which would have unleashed other aid in 2011, was a big mistake on behalf of those at the time who said that they didn't want it or need the loan. And I think that as a result, we're left with very significant negative consequences. I think that the current government want to try to delay as much as possible any tough decisions, although that said, they have announced that from the 1st of July, there will be a number of actions taken to cut subsidies, but it won't make a big dent in the overall bill. And the bigger issues, such as tackling the key petrol subsidy, is still not on the cards, and all the various other subsidies. It's tinkering around the edges. I think the key point is to try to get it to the people that really help and want it and need it. The government, for example, the poorest people are not on the grid to receive natural gas. So the more rich receive the natural gas that's piped in. They don't have cars. The richer who have cars are being subsidized. I only heard this morning someone who said that when they fill up their car, they pay 100 Egyptian pounds to fill up their tank. The government is paying 400 pounds to pay for the subsidy.
100 Egyptian pounds is what in dollars?
It's about, say, $15. $15, $16.
Egypt does have, I think it's the third or fourth lowest petroleum prices or in the world after places like Venezuela and others, you know, oil producers. It's certainly the only country that isn't a net oil exporter that has such low fuel costs. So that's clearly unsustainable.
Absolutely. It really has to be tackled quickly. But the issue with the IMF is they want to see the government have at least a good program to cut the subsidies and really reform. But they're also looking for pro-growth parts of that plan, and there's nothing there to see at the moment, unfortunately. I think that's a major disappointment for me and my team, that you'd like to see an adjustment to try to improve sentiment, and there's really nothing that's positive so far that would really help induce change
of sentiment. Why is this? I mean, what is there amongst the political leadership classes, whatever you want to call them? It's not just the Brotherhood, I think, that seems to put this at a lower priority than you or I. I mean, if we somehow became the president of Egypt, then the economy would be our number one priority. We're both sort of economists and in that area, so that's perhaps natural. But it really seems to me that they don't want to make the economy go forward. They're not willing to take any decisions, let alone difficult ones, to get the economy moving. What do they not view the economy as important? I mean, they say they do, but you know, what is it? What's behind all this?
Actually, Richard, that's a key question. I think that there's been, I think I said over the last 2 years, decision to try to wait till allow other people to take tough decisions, and it keeps being delayed, and now the election's been delayed, which should have been held already under the constitution. It should already have been held, and now they're delayed until after Ramadan, so we're going to have them maybe in October. There, as I said, there's some tinkering around the edges in the summer, but they keep, I think, because some people are afraid of taking tough decisions, afraid of having people going back out on the streets. The problem is at some stage, and it's going to happen pretty soon, the government may not have money. The receiving of aid and help from Qatar and Libya has only delayed the inevitable decisions that are going to have to be made. But I think it's competency levels. I think it's lack of vision. And I think the individuals in charge, whether it's the president but I think it is both, the prime minister and his cabinet, basically are really not doing a good job at all in terms of the economic governance of Egypt. And it really failed. And I think there are elements within the Muslim Brotherhood who are also exceptionally disappointed, if not angry, at the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood are losing such support across the country because the economy is being managed so badly. There's no clear answer in this. And I think there's also an element of denial, basically, of problem, which is also another issue.
Well, I think my personal opinion, for what it's worth, is that the latter of that, because it's not really a question of the economy being mismanaged. It's just not being managed at all. I mean, it's not that they're making a lot of really stupid decisions. They're just not making any decisions of any consequence. You know, they, as you say, they tinker around the edges, a penny here, a penny there. a few nice words, announcements of all sorts of things. But if you drill down, look behind the headlines, very little, as far as I can see, is actually happening. Let's quickly close with the role of Qatar in Egypt. QNB's bought Soc Gen's Egyptian subsidiary. QInvest, I think, will this week, we hope, conclude its transaction of core parts of EFG Hermes's business. The Qataris have deposited $2 billion in the Central Bank of Egypt. They are said to be doing more. Do you see this as something that will continue, that the Qatari investment is based on a long-term vision of Qatar, that Egypt is a good market for it, or is it more of a political decision on behalf of the Qataris to support or to increase their political clout within the region?
I think it's interesting this, the Qatar. I was there last week, and Qatar has very strongly nailed itself to the success or failure of the Muslim Brotherhood. They have a bigger vision of the region having a kind of economic renaissance and wanting the region to improve. And they've put a lot of, or a significant amount of cash to help Egypt in particular. The problem is within Egypt, that's not always perceived in a positive way, that Egypt's going out with a begging bowl. The fact that Egypt's also, despite sitting on lots of gas, it's having to buy in gas to supply export commitments to Jordan in particular. And the fact that the possibility, there had been until recently, at least, the prospect of a summer full of electricity cuts. I think it's useful, the aid is definitely helping, and it's useful to see one country coming to the aid of another. The issue, though, as I've said, that one is delaying, the government's delaying the inevitable. But in the case of Qatar, they're buying assets in a variety of countries, particularly in the United Kingdom, in terms of assets and companies and real estate and so on. And I think they have very significant intent to invest further beyond the banking sector in Egypt into real estate, into development of helping the development of the new Suez Canal corridor, which has been planned the next decade. And I think they've probably won some conditions, albeit quietly, from the Muslim Brotherhood or other bodies within the Egyptian state.
But $2 billion plus deposit in of sovereign funds in the central banks is quite a nice insurance policy to have.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're bailing out the country on supporting the country on a sovereign basis, it makes your investments of your businesses less harder to tamper with from a government perspective. I mean, I don't know how related they are, but there would seem to be a little bit of an insurance policy in there that the Qataris will be well treated, not preferentially treated, but that the rule of law will apply to their investments. Dan, tell us a little bit about the Egyptian Sukuk law that seems to bounce between the Al-Azhar Mosque, the Shura Council, and the presidency. Do you think that it's really going to unleash all this extra capital that some of the Egyptian government say that it will?
Well, I think this is interesting. The thought on this is that one of the things we didn't mention perhaps is the cacophony of voices that has also stalled the process in Egypt on any decision that being made, be it the IMF loan or the Sukuk. It's been back and forth, as you say. It does seem to be that they are getting closer to an agreement finally now. It's the latest is that the Al-Azhar have said that they will approve it with some changes, which is a better stance than they had just earlier this week when they said that there were several things that were incompatible with Sharia. I don't think that it is actually the Sharia aspects that are causing controversy in this decision. I think it's more to do with the use or the expected use of government assets and the thought that they could be, you know, sold off by the back door to foreign investors, be it the Suez Canal, etc.
So what you're saying, Dan, let me, because this is actually a very interesting thing, and I hadn't thought about it, is that the Sukuk law might enable the government to use state assets as the underlying security for these Sukuks. So essentially, they're sort of securitizing cash flows on things like the Suez Canal or tourism or receivables or anything really. Is that right?
Exactly. And this is the irony of the situation, is that they are being talked about in terms of whether they are Sharia compliant, whether the law allows loopholes that would allow things to happen that aren't Sharia compliant. But in actual fact, what they're really talking about is the use of assets. And I mean, the irony of this is that Sukuk are asset backed or asset based transactions. So, for something to be Sharia compliant in that sense, it needs to have assets behind it. And government assets are obviously what they're going to need for a government sukuk. There's been a lot of to and fro between, the government, the Shura Council, Al-Azhar to iron this out and make sure that there is a unified version of the sukuk law that everyone can agree on. We don't know what the vested interests are behind the scenes. Who's negotiating for what that isn't coming out in the public debate. But I think that they are getting closer. There could be a sukuk. They've targeted before the end of June as when they want to issue. How big that will be, we don't know. There's been claims that the Islamic Development Bank, for instance, could come in with, $6 billion or something for sukuk. I think that's, probably largely inflated or optimistic. But they certainly want to get something, a first deal out before the end of June. Whether that comes sooner than that, we don't know. There was some talk it might even come in April. That doesn't look so likely now, given the recent debating. But it could come soon.
Well, that's interesting, Dan. Keep us posted on that, because I think we should, if and when this is passed, and if and when a transaction looks imminent, we should perhaps do a special feature on it to really look at what it means beyond just the sukuk issuance structure, but actually at the underlying strategy of the government, which might be able to be read through what the underlying assets are.
Certainly. And I think the problem they may face is that, and this goes back to what Angus was saying about fiddling in the margins, which has been done all along, is that the international investor base may have lost a bit of interest in this in the meantime. I think when originally people were looking at Egypt, they said, we'll just wait and see how the political situation pans out, because we can't take we're happy to take the financial risk, perhaps, but not the political risk. I've got the sense that a lot of people have just stop focusing on Egypt so much in terms of the sukuk issuance in recent months, because of all this constant negotiating and arguments that have been happening. I hope that we'll see some more interest coming back if they do get closer.
Yeah, but I mean, a sukuk secured on the receipts of the Suez Canal would be issued in dollars would be quite an interesting transaction. I mean, how it plays internally within Egypt is one question, but it's a nice asset. It generates north of $100 million a month. You could potentially get quite a lot of bang for that particular buck.
Certainly could. I think that that people will still want to see that, the other topics we talked about, the political will is there to get things done. Unified approach. I think that they'll want to see that as well. And they want to see that there isn't going to be some kind of, big blow up again in that regard.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Let's keep our eye on that. Thanks, Dan. Good. Okay. Well, listen, I mean, we've gone on longer than we thought, as always, when I get both of you together. Thank you very much, Dan and Angus.
Thank you.
I'm going to end this first Middle East podcast by doing another commercial for our Saudi event. Go to euromoneyconferences.com/Saudi to see the agenda. It's a remarkable lineup of Saudi economic leaders, corporate leaders. So we have CEOs or CFOs of most of the major issuers and companies within Saudi Arabia, both public and private, as well as a very interesting series of people from the international markets. And it's going to be an excellent couple of days. I hope you can all come. If you haven't got a visa, we can help you get one, but you need to do that fast. So please go online. Registrations are up 20% this year, but we do have room still. excuse me, and we won't close registration until the end of April. Good. That's it for us this month. I am very much looking forward to doing another one of these next month, and I hope that both Dan and Angus will join me. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to the Euromoney Online Channels podcast for April 2013. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll visit our website at euromoneyconferences.com/online channels to register, download, and view all of our content and video from our live events.